Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Cedarville Stories podcast. I'm Mark Weinstein, and today on the podcast, I'm talking with Parker Adams, a 2014 graduate of Cedarville University. You may not know much about Parker, but if you've attended your local movie theaters to watch movies like Woodlawn or I Still Believe, the movie about Jeremy Camp's life, or his most recent movie, Ordinary Angels, then you've seen the work of Parker Adams. Parker has established a solid career in editing some of the most watched Christian movies in recent years, and we will talk about this today on the podcast. Parker is the founder of 1520 Creative, a communications firm in Nashville. He and his wife, Kara, also a 2014 graduate, are parents of two boys, and today Parker is in our studio to share his faith story and commitment to Jesus through the motion picture. Parker, great to have you in studio.
Thanks, Mark. Glad to be here.
So what brings you back to campus today? It's a cold, rainy day.
We have a couple things going on. I initially was coming out just to do a screening for one of the films that's releasing that I edited called Unsung Hero. I'm also kind of serving on the advisory council to help improve the major.
That's great. So when I was preparing for this program, I noticed that you're from Omaha, Nebraska. You're a graduate of Omaha Christian High School. Was there a connection between your church and your school with Cedarville, or how did you find Cedarville University to come as a student?
I was born in the Kansas City area, Olathe, Kansas.
Okay.
Grew up there. My parents had been there for a long time. My dad went to KU for his master's, and so I grew up there until I was about 13.
Okay.
And moved. And I have two older siblings, and my sister, Teresa, is 10 years older, and my brother, Ryan, is 8 years older than me. And they both attended. So that was the natural step as far as visiting Cedarville and taking a look. And I looked at other places, and there was definitely a desire to be different, you know, as the youngest and the, sure. It's like, oh, I want to do something different. But I really felt at home here. There was a lot of good opportunity for me. And coming out of high school, I had doing track and football and that kind of stuff. I ended up having a scholarship to do track here. And so that was another advantage to coming out. And it was kind of a natural path. And there wasn't really a connection necessarily between high school or college. It was more familial. I think one of the things that's not necessarily thought through as often about the college experience, and I don't think I would have recognized it at the time, but see it more now, is just it goes so much further beyond the academic side of it.
Yeah.
And being able to have an environment. I mean, I miss so much the days of chapel and the opportunity to spend time in worship every day in a more communal, aspect. Yeah. And there's just so much about that that I think you take for granted while you're here.
And if you miss it and you can't get it where you are in Tennessee, there's a live stream that we live stream
That's
all
true,
our chapels.
Yeah.
So feel free to join in when you can. Cedarville's where you met Kara. Tell me how you guys connected, how you met, and there has to be a story there somewhere.
It was interesting because we had the same friend group.
Oh, did you? Okay.
And never met until our senior year of college.
Yeah.
We kind of interacted with all the same people, but never really crossed paths ourselves. And senior year, there was a bonfire at one of the houses off campus that we had attended. It was the house that I was living at. And so that was kind of the first time we met. It was like one of the first weekends of the school year. It was funny because from that point on, over the course of the next 2 weeks, we ran into each other on campus a half dozen times in ways that were so unexplainable. What happened was we were pulling into parking spaces next to each other at the exact same time, getting out and then walking the same direction to class. She attended a different church than she normally goes to, and she ended up sitting in front of me, and we ended up talking after. And so there's kind of a long list of things. I ended up having a meeting for work doing some of the help with video, and it turned out that she worked in that office. So she was talking to her boss, and she's like, hey, sorry, I'm running into meetings. Oh, what's going on? She's like, I have a meeting with a guy, video guy, whatever. His name's Parker. And she's like, you mean Parker Adams? it's like, and so it was another one of those where we just kept running. And so she acted like she had no idea I was coming in. Oh, wow, it's running into you again. But it was only really a couple weekends of running into each other before we started talking more. And then her friends ended up ditching us on a movie night, so we ended up just being able to watch a movie together, and so then we started dating and got married about a year later.
And you've been married what?
Yeah, almost 10 years.
10 years.
Yeah.
The work that you do is a profession, but it's also a ministry. When did you realize God was calling you into this kind of work to share messages of hope through movies.
I actually think that's a great way to put it. There's been very few moments in my life where I've felt the exact prompting and direction of the Lord. You know, oftentimes it's prayerful reliance on him and that kind of stuff. But it was after my freshman year, was majoring in the same thing, but a different concentration. I was looking at doing animation. And after my freshman year, I had a very visceral moment with the Lord at home where I felt very directly that he was calling me to step in and make movies and to do it with excellence and to do it as a Christian with excellence in a way that the story isn't the thing getting in the way from the message being told. And I wasn't being specifically called, and I still don't feel specifically called to making films that are faith-based.
Okay.
That's why I like that spread messages of hope and all of that. But I think ultimately what I was called to be is a steward of what the Lord has given me and to be a Christian in the space. And the Lord has me doing faith-based films. And, you know, that's kind of a genre that has a little bit of a negative connotation.
Right.
But I'm excited to see the way it's growing. The thing that I felt was being a light in the dark place is what's important and what's needed, but you have to be able to do it with excellence.
Yep.
And that's actually, you mentioned my company earlier, 1520 Creative. The name came from Romans 1520, where Paul is talking about how he doesn't need to preach the gospel. He doesn't want to go preach the gospel where it's already been heard. It's about spreading the message to the place where they haven't heard. And ultimately, I just wanted the Lord's fingerprint on my life to show through in the work that I was doing, regardless of if it was specifically preaching the gospel, but for redemption and hope to shine through in whatever I was doing.
Jesus didn't come to be with the healthy. He came to heal the sick. And that's what really what you feel like you're called to. You're called to be light and hope in a dark world.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
And you have a great opportunity to do that. To get where you are, I have to believe Cedarville played a key role. I have to believe there's some professors here or have retired who have played a key role in helping you learn and grow. Who are some of those professors who have really impacted your personal and professional lives?
Yeah, well, I think there's a wide list of names to go down the list on that. You know, one of the first ones that comes to mind is Mr. Kregel. And, you know, he's since retired. With him being on the video side and the film side, I spent a lot of time with him. And had, you know, he created a lot of opportunities, both in doing some of the sports broadcasting and just in the shooting of films. And then his son, David, who graduated a few years before us, ended up coming back on campus while I was here to kind of gather some students together and shoot a short sitcom. And we did a whole writer's room, and we, you know, we ended up getting a budget together, and we shot over the course of a couple weeks leading into my junior year, I think.
Okay.
And that ended up sparking a pretty strong relationship with him, a creative relationship, especially over the years, where we've continued to bounce ideas off each other. And that was really one of the biggest relationships that came out. And so I've kept, you know, connected with the Kregels over the years and continue to talk with David on a regular basis. Mr. Leitenheimer, you know, in his audio video class, and they kind of, he created an opportunity for me to shoot a short film that we could all collaborate on across the thing and to be able to kind of direct that process. And, you know, there's just so many, you know, Mr. Simon was my original advisor. And because I switched to animation, he ended up staying as my advisor. So I had a unique opportunity to stay kind of in the motion graphics, animation, and effects side of things, but to still have Kregel's influence on the video and film side. Yeah. And so it was an interesting opportunity to cross the boundaries, I guess, of those two concentrations that I wouldn't have otherwise had if I hadn't started as animation.
In the movie making business, what are some typical challenges that you face as the editor? And then also, how did you get your start in this business?
I'll start with how I got my start.
Sure.
You know, I think a lot of people look at it and it's like, how do you break into the industry? That was kind of a term. And at the beginning, especially when I was having this moment with the Lord about this is what I want you to do. At that moment, I really felt I had no path to the industry. I saw, you know, movies were a thing you had to break into, or film was a thing. That was a whole industry. You had to move out to LA. You had to, you know, sleep, you know, in the parking lot of the studio and just hope to get a job and make it in. Cedarville had connections and opportunities and internships and that kind of stuff. But a lot of them were more on the broadcast side at the time and everything. Right. And so I really just didn't have a path. And it's become kind of a cheesy mantra. But my prayer in that moment and what came out of my spirit was, you know, Lord, I don't have a path forward to become what you're asking me to become. I don't see a path to that just because I don't have those connections. And the prayer that came out was, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you my best and let you take care of the rest.
That's great.
And ultimately, that has rung true over and over and over again in my path. And it's really just about whatever you put in front of me, whether you want me to do this or that, I'm just going to do my best with it and try to be a steward of it and trust and hope that I'll be faithful with that and you can provide me with more. And it's just been incredible to watch him open doors for me in a way that I'm not the one opening doors or providing, and I'm just doing what I can with what he's given. So a good example of that is that while on campus, I ended up getting a call that from my mom that the Kendrick brothers were doing a seminar, a little film seminar, kind of a morning workshop at my church, which has no affiliation with my high school, but that night they were also going to be keynote speakers at my high school for a banquet. The connection between my high school and church was not there. So they just happened to be, they were going to be in town for one day. They were going to be at my church in the morning and they were going to be at my school at night. Well, that was back in Omaha, Nebraska. And it was going to be, I was finding out, a night or two before.
And where were you living then?
We were in Omaha, Nebraska that was happening. And then I was at Cedarville at the time.
You were at Cedarville. Okay. So you had to get back to.
It was 1 week before a break, the weekend before. So I ended up having to convince some professor, it wasn't much convincing, but I had to let them know I really, it'd be helpful if I could go home. So a week early, basically, and I had to postpone some exams, and they were all gracious enough to say, go do it. So I drove home as quick as I could. I went to the morning session and met with them and just introduced myself and let them know I was going to be at the high school that night, and then listened to the high school keynote speak. And I talked with them after. And this moment happened where I waited in line as people talked to them and kind of waited to be the last person. And on the spot, as I walked up, they said, hey, do you want to work on our next movie?
Really?
Out of nowhere. And I couldn't believe it. I had a moment after that meeting where we were getting in the elevator and it just hit me, this rush of, I can't believe they just asked me out of the blue to do that. And what was cool and what I couldn't see at that point, they were originally going to be shooting that summer. And it kept getting postponed and kept getting postponed until after I graduated.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. And so the story continues, but I connecting with them over the course of those years and just continuing to email every few months and touch base. After I graduated, we were actually on our way up to see family in Minnesota, and I had been keeping track of their thing. And I got a notification on Facebook that they were going into principal photography on Monday morning, and it was Saturday night. And I thought, I guess I'm not on the team. Like, I guess I'm not doing it. They're shooting in North Carolina. We're on our way up to Minnesota. And so I just shot him a message and said, praying for you guys. Hope I can help in any way along the way. But, hope it goes well. Really excited for you guys. And I got a call the next morning from a producer. I had a voicemail when I woke up and we were in Minnesota. He said, I'm looking for Adam Parker. so I called him back. He let me know there was a position available as a PA. It was unpaid and all this stuff. But I had to get there the next night. And so we ended up immediately driving back home. I drove through the night. I was able to stay at my brother's house, who was still living here in the area. And just, I stayed at his, slept for a couple of hours. And then I arrived in the morning as they started the first day. And I was able to kind of step into that.
So that started your career.
That was the film. Yeah. The first break into the film industry.
Was that for Woodlawn?
No, that was for a movie called War Room.
Okay. We'll talk about that in a little bit.
Okay.
So besides some of the challenges you just said, what are some typical challenges that you face in your editing process that maybe you surprised?
Editing is like having a puzzle that's ill-defined edges. And you have to figure out how to put the picture together in a way that makes the most sense to people. It's often painting a portrait when the vision is a picture. You have to understand how to convey exactly the vision, not only of the director, and sometimes even be able to look beyond the vision of the director if it wasn't captured on set the way that they had hoped. But oftentimes it's challenges that people don't think about, continuity things that can completely interrupt the flow of an edit. If you're noticing it, it's a problem, but nobody, when it's done right, notices it because it's not a problem. And so oftentimes those things go really under the radar. But often the biggest challenge is just the ability to sift through hours and hours and hours of raw footage to recognize the few moments that are the right moments that can capture people's emotion, not just as the actor, but to evoke the same emotion in an audience. And so like an example with the film Ordinary Angels, there's a whole snow sequence at the end of the film that almost turns into an action sequence. There's a race against time to get this little girl to the helicopter. And it was really one of the first more action-y sequences that I had edited. But when you look at, there's just a scene at the end where the there's a helicopter arriving in the snowstorm. It's a whiteout condition, and they're not sure that he's going to be able to land, and they're going to be able to get around the helicopter. And that scene alone, just in the raw footage, was, you know, 8 to 10 hours of footage to walk through and then to cut together. And that scene, just that little moment of the scene, maybe lasts 90 seconds to 2 minutes. And making those choices is really the most difficult challenge, is to understand what moments the audience needs to see, but in an efficient way that doesn't make the movie too long. And
for that scene and that movie, Ordinary Angels, like, are you on set for any of this, or you're just waiting for the footage to come to you and then you put it together?
Yeah, so it depends on the director. I work with some directors who really prefer to have the editor on set, but I'm on set working. So the moment that they start shooting is the moment I start getting footage to start working. So Typically I'm about a day behind, and this is all kind of the logistics side, but they typically, if they're shooting their footage on day one, it's being delivered to an assistant editor on day two. And then that assistant editor preps the project, gets the footage ready for me, and I'm actually starting on day three as far as my actual sitting down and working with the footage to start editing a scene. So yes, there are some directors who prefer to have me on set, and it's more just their proximity and the ability for them to step into the edit and do work. And then there's other times I'm working completely remote. They shot Ordinary Angels in Canada,
right?
And I never left my house. I edited the movie from my house.
My wife and I saw the movie. It was very, very well done. Thank you. Very good story. Just curious. So that scene, there's a lot of snow.
Mm-hmm.
Is that really snow, or is that fake snow?
Yeah. So they did have snow in the area, and they tried to time things with some of the heavy snow that was happening at the time.
Okay.
But it's a combination. So they've got, there's a mix of doing snow machines, real snow, and then there's visual effects added for the snow, especially getting it to a point of whiteout condition and the fog and the, you know, so they do what they can on set to help on the visual effects side. So you're not starting from a clean plate, but sometimes that can actually get in the way too.
Parker, it's been my observation, and I'm a novice, so I'm not a big movie goer, never have been. What I have noticed though is Christian movies specifically have gotten better. The quality is better. I don't know if that's the acting, the directing, the editing. I don't know. Why are movies from a faith-based perspective getting better? And what are the important ingredients to make them high quality?
Well, there's definitely a few different things that are impacting that. In the early years of faith-based film, the resources were much smaller and it was much more expensive to make a movie.
Okay.
So the equipment itself was far more expensive. You know, back when shooting on film, it was far more cumbersome and expensive to just be up and operational to be able to do it. The second part of it is, as they have grown as this specific niche in Hollywood, studios and other companies have started to recognize that there's a market there. So to some extent, there's the monetization side of what makes it possible now to get funding that are going to support that kind of, you know, so early years, it was faith-based films were spending less than $2 million, you know, often just because there was no support for such a small niche. But as the Kendrick brothers and the Irwin brothers continue to kind of pave the way through, you know, breaking down barriers and starting to really make money in theaters, that started to get Hollywood's attention or the studio's attention to go like, well, we could capitalize on this. Why you know, why let them do all? And so there's been some really interesting partnerships that have happened. You know, the Irwin brothers with Kingdom Story Company have partnered with Lionsgate over the past few years. And that has provided them with the ability to make them more efficiently, but to also have much more funding behind them. And what's been really encouraging is the studios, many of the studios in Hollywood are really embracing and recognizing not only the need for that genre, and some of it is about revenue and all of that. Absolutely.
Sure it is. Absolutely.
It's a business.
That's right.
But the other side of it that's encouraging is that they look at the type of story that's being told and they recognize that they don't know how to tell it. And the whole point is we need to bring somebody who actually understands the market, who knows the stories, because they've done their own attempts at faith-based film or that kind of thing. But it often falls flat because it's not coming from a genuine spirit of, you know, faith, living in faith and right. having that understanding and knowing the culture of that. And so it's been encouraging, you know, Amazon Prime has come on with a new studio called The Wonder Project that I've been recently brought onto, And it's the same idea. It's like, we don't know how to make these movies. We need you to do it because we know there's a market there. We know it's an important market and we don't know how to do it. And so that's been encouraging.
I think it's interesting to see that you have the secular world reaching out to the Christian community to tell these stories because they don't know how to do it. Yet it's just advancing the gospel. It's advancing key messages. That goes back to your calling, right? To be salt and light. And how surprising is it to you, being young in the industry still, that the secular world is reaching out to the Christian world for those kind of stories?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of a Trojan horse, and I'm kind of stealing a term from John Irwin here, but he talks about it on a global front. There's so many ways that movies can't, you know, we can't get the gospel into certain countries, but if it does a certain amount in the box office in the U.S., that movie will be brought worldwide into countries that can't receive the gospel, but we can present the gospel, or we can present, you know, faith and Jesus in films in other countries. But it actually, I think, applies in a more central way within the studios. You look at the heads of studios and all they're reaching out for the opportunity of revenue. They see it as a bottom line opportunity. At the end of the day, they're sitting in the theaters reviewing these films, watching people be impacted by these films and truly impacted, you know, themselves.
Yeah.
And I think that's, they don't even know that they're putting themselves in the position
right.
to be impacted. And I think that's what's really, really exciting.
You can do your job well and put a great movie together, but we as listeners to this podcast have a great opportunity to support those kind of
Absolutely.
Movies, because as those get supported and the revenue raises to that level, it allows us to spread the gospel worldwide. I mean, I hadn't even thought about that until you mentioned that, but that's a great opportunity for us as consumers of movies to really get out there and support the faith-based movies for evangelism purposes. So I encourage our listeners to do that. Let's go back to Ordinary Angels. I noticed that was a two-hour movie. How long does it take you to edit and complete a two-hour movie like Ordinary Angels?
If I'm remembering right, it was about 28 weeks of editorial for Ordinary Angels, but that does not include, obviously, all of the process that happens after I'm done. Once the edit is completed, then they send it over to a colorist who's going to make it look good. They're going to send it over to a mixer who's going to make it sound good. And then the visual effects have to be finished. And we're kind of doing a lot of that stuff at the same time, trying to lay in some of the visual effects as we go. It's a cumbersome process. Usually we don't even have a first edit for 2 to 3 months. So getting the first cut, you know, is really the first milestone of the work. And once we've done that, then it's just about chipping away, because you typically the first cut is going to be far too long, and you need to see everything so you can understand what things are working and what things you need to be removed and what things are redundant.
Is 2 hour the maximum time that you want to try to get a movie in, or what's optimal?
A studio likes to see that the film is coming in short of a 2 hour, just because it's typically a more palatable number for people who are looking, well, how long's the movie when I'm going to go see it? From a marketing standpoint, to go, if it shows 2 hours, that seems a lot longer to us than like hour 47. You know, it's typically trying to stay, at least in this genre, under 2 hours. But often you see movies that are longer than that.
Okay. So in terms of movies, I mentioned that you edited I Still Believe, the Jeremy Camp story. Were you on set for that? Were you able to meet Jeremy and his family? Or tell us a little bit about that movie.
Yeah. So that was unique. That was the first film that I edited for the Irwin brothers. And I got to collaborate with another filmmaker named Ben Smallbone on that as an editor. And Andy Irwin, one of the brothers, was in that with us as well. We really tag teamed that edit together. Okay. For the Irwin brothers, that experience, we shot in Mobile, Alabama.
Okay.
And we had an old church bus that we converted into an edit suite. But had two different stations where you could edit inside of this old church bus.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then we had a Sprinter van that was also converted into an edit suite and kind of a director's suite. And so every day on set, those would get set up and we would come in and work out of those spaces just for the proximity of being on set. So I have some really interesting photos of being on the beach in a church bus, you know, with a view of the ocean while I'm editing. And that was an interesting and a unique experience just to be on set, not only just in proximity of like in a hotel nearby or I'm in an office nearby, but we were driven onto set every day to actually work from that space. So I was able to meet Jeremy, and I'm trying to remember if I think we met him on set, but I can't remember for sure. But we've actually run into him a couple times and been able to talk a bit since then. But my wife had the unique experience, and if people don't know the story, you know, his first wife, Melissa, ended up passing away from cancer.
Right.
And there was a lot of ups and downs in that journey. And she kept journals, and that's kind of part of the story. She kept journals about her journey. A part of my process on that film was actually building and editing the pitch video that helps kind of the studio green light the press. So they need to be able to see. So they went up and shot interviews with the real Jeremy and his current wife. We kind of built out the story to understand so they could see. And so it was all this, the footage, real footage of his family and right. all that. And my wife had the unique experience of transcribing the original journal. So taking the original journal right. and so that it could be read and it more easily. So without the cursive and without it being had to be handed around. And so she spent many, many nights crying as she sat and typed out the journal of this woman who had such incredible faith in what God was doing with her life. And
yeah.
But yeah, so it's been kind of a cool way to have been connected to that project.
Yeah, Jeremy was just in Dayton recently,
okay.
and my wife and I went to the concert. Seeing that movie and then seeing him in concert just had more meaning to me because I knew his story
yeah.
that you were able to tell in the movie. Your oldest son, Cash, he's 5 years old, is the youngest person to ever be credited in a movie. What movie was he in and how old was he?
I should add an asterisk that I believe he is right. the youngest to ever be credited. The first film that I ever was able to edit, first feature film narrative, was a movie called Unplanned. And the backstory of that film is it's a true story about a woman who worked at Planned Parenthood as a director of one of the facilities. In an emergency, she had to step in and kind of oversee an abortion. And in doing so, she watched on the ultrasound as the fetus fought back and struggled against the abortion. Mm. And she was just broken by that moment. And she realized that it is that they are alive and they feel pain. They
yeah.
all this. And she has since become a huge advocate against Planned Parenthood and abortion. And so it was really following her journey during the film or right before we started, we found out we were pregnant with our first Cash. And so my wife actually had come out, Kara had come out and worked on the film with me, and she was in the accounting department and helping. She's pregnant the whole time, and we were getting ultrasounds and like the video ultrasounds while we were out there. And so I ended up laying in for some of the moments where we're seeing ultrasound throughout the film. I ended up laying in some of the existing video as kind of a visual effects over the screen because they didn't have anything on the screens yet. We came up with the idea, especially with the theme of the film and the recognition that it's life at conception.
Yeah.
They're like, what if we credited this baby
yeah.
who hasn't even been born yet as a statement to recognize that it's life before birth, you know? And
that's very meaningful.
And so it's a really cool, he has his own IMDb page and everything. It's official recognition of his work on the project.
And that seems to go hand in hand with, as you told me earlier, how outgoing he is.
Well, I always say if he ends up going on to be a performer or an actor, I'll be able to say, he's been acting since before he was born. You know?
that's very true. Parker, I think next week or very soon, the movie Unsung Heroes is going to be released.
Yeah, it'll be April 26th. And you can get tickets earlier, April 24th.
A week from the airing of this podcast, go see this movie. But you had a unique experience in traveling with the band for King and Country. Share with us briefly that experience, because that was something that I don't think you had done before.
So Unsung Hero follows the story of the family of the band for King and Country. And it's their parents' story.
Okay.
And so the director of that film is Joel, who is one of the leaders of for King and Country. And he co-directed with a guy named Richard Ramsey. And what was unique about this is that his life as a musician doesn't stop or making a movie. And so they continued to have different tours that they needed to go on. So they found a short window of time that they could shoot the film where he could not be touring. And then they're going on tour almost immediately after. And so one of the unique experiences that I don't expect to have outside of working with them, I guess, again,
yeah.
is that I would go out on tour with them and sleep in the tour bus, and we'd load everything out, work for a while. The show would happen, even in intermission, Joel would come back and sit down and we keep editing the movie. And then, you know, his 15 minutes would be up and he'd run back out and be dancing on the stage and doing everything. And then the show would be over and we'd keep working until midnight, until the buses were ready to leave and we'd load in, go to sleep and wake up in a new city. And so it was a really unique experience. Sleeping on a tour bus is a unique experience by itself, but doing it, you know, in the midst of editing a film, I think is one that not many people will have.
Is it easy to sleep on a tour bus? Or
the first night is the most difficult because it's such a small space, and I don't have claustrophobia or anything like that, but getting used to that feeling and being able to sleep the first night is more difficult. The second night and third night and fourth, as it goes on, you kind of just, you conk out because you're so exhausted from the loadout, just the travel. But yeah, I mean, it's three bunks high on the tour bus and, you know, two wide. You have about 18 inches of space above, you know, on between the bed and the thing. And you've got your own little air vent, you got your own little plug, and you got a curtain. And that's kind of what you're doing. I can't imagine doing it all the time, but.
How long were you on tour with them?
So I ended up going out for two separate weekends. So luckily I wasn't out there over and over. And that's one of the unique things they do with their tour. I'm sure other bands do it as well, but they're typically go out Thursday through Sunday. So they get to come back and be home and handle other stuff Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And so it was really just going out on spurts. And so I was out on their Christmas tour for some, and there was another tour that I ended up going out that was their traditional tour.
If there are young students listening to this program or parents of young students who are interested in your kind of work or an education like what you received at Cedarville, what advice would you give them?
I think so much of it is stepping outside of your comfort zone in the early. I really miss the early years of creative exploration, I guess, when you're first doing things. Growing up, I did a lot of music production and that kind of stuff. And one of the things I miss, it was the freedom to create without concern of other people's thoughts. I mean, at the time, I definitely felt the concern of other people's thoughts. But looking back, for everybody to just be supportive in that when you're younger and to not necessarily look at it as like, well, how good are you at what you're doing? And
and
so I think in the early stages, it's really just about going out and just doing it as much as possible without concern for what people are thinking. Use whatever you have in front of you to do what you love and to do what you want to do. Because even nowadays, you can shoot with your iPhone, you can record on your laptop. There's so many different ways to pursue that. It's really just about not letting yourself feel limited because you think you don't have what it takes or, you know, or the resources necessary.
Yeah. And I'd also encourage anyone who is looking for a solid education in communication, in this part of communication, movies, radio, audio, video, to check out Cedarville University, cedarville.edu. And with that, Parker, my last question centers around an upcoming TV show called The House of David that you're going to be part of. What is the purpose of the show? And then tell me, like, where is it filmed? When is it going to be filmed? How long will it take? Give me some information about this because this sounds really interesting. This sounds a little different than what you've been doing currently.
Yeah, so I was recently brought on to a new studio called The Wonder Project as head of post-production VFX. And the exciting thing about what they're doing is they're expanding this ministry of hope and the opportunity to create values-based content, faith-based content beyond the theaters and now into streaming platforms as television shows. They'll still do films. Stuff will still be in theaters. But this one explores a new partnership with Amazon Prime. And so this will continue to kind of run alongside Kingdom Story Company and the Kendrick Brothers as we kind of are all competitive allies pushing towards the ultimate means of spreading the gospel and hope and joy. And so what's exciting for me is I've always been drawn to series-based content. I love the long-form relationship you get with the characters and the way that you can, and on the creative side, the ability to take an audience on that journey. So House of David is a kind of an epic exploration of the life of David. And I think it's going to be a really visceral experience. Yeah. And so I'm excited there. The hope and the plan is to begin filming in Greece in May. And it's such a different experience than shooting a film. It's not a 6-week shoot or whatever. It just is kind of this ongoing thing as long as we have the green light to continue. In my role at the studio, I'm going to be helping kind of oversee some of the post-production development and making sure our systems and processes and everything are working well. And then in the more hands-on day-to-day, there's going to be different episodes that I'll be taking a stab at the edit.
How long do you think you'll be in Greece?
So it kind of depends on how many blocks is what they call it, how many blocks of filming I'm out there for, and how often, you know, if I'm currently editing on it or if I'm just kind of helping facilitate and manage. So my guess is, I mean, they're going to be out there in Greece from now until maybe it'll be like July that they're wrapping up the second block. I can't remember now, but either way, so I'll probably be there on and off. My hope is for no longer than, you know, a month at a time, but there's a good chance that, you know, it could be several months.
Will you be able to bring Kara and your boys?
So I have the opportunity. It's really about navigating whether we want to uproot everything. And it's going to depend. If I'm there for 3 months, that's a different story that if I'm going to be back and forth every couple weeks, right? Our current household conversation is what do we want to do and how do we want to navigate the next few months?
Well, Parker, our time has ended. I really enjoyed getting to know you more. I know our listeners, if they didn't know Parker Adams when the program started, they know a little bit more about you at this point. Thank you for being faithful to your calling, for sharing the hope and the good news of Jesus through your various work. And I just wish you continued best as you continue down that path. Thanks for joining me also for this podcast.
Absolutely. Thanks, Mark.
I want to thank you for listening to the Cedarville Stories podcast brought to you by Cedarville University. You are encouraged to share, like, and review this podcast on your favorite podcast provider. And be sure to come back next week when we'll hear another Cedarville story for God's glory.